It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent, and we have author Tim O'Brien here. His literary career has brought us novels and memoirs and short stories. He has given countless English classes the fodder for deep discussions around war with his book, The Things They Carried. And his new book is a gift. It's a tribute to fatherhood and leaving a piece of himself for his sons. Did you become a parent later in life? What was that experience like? Did your father impart life lessons? Join in at 800-642-1234. Tim O'Brien is the author of 10 books, including the classic Vietnam War novel, The Things They Carried, which was a finalist for the Pulitzer in 1991, and Going After Cassiato, which won the National Book Award in 1979. He's a Purple Heart recipient, a Vietnam veteran. His most recent book is called Dad's Maybe Book, and he's speaking at Boswell Book Company in Milwaukee tonight at 7, and he joins us from WBEZ in Chicago. Tim O'Brien, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Oh, thanks so much for having me.
Well, what you bring to us are snippets of life with kids. How did you allow yourself permission to let fragments be fragments, to let go of structure and narrative, and just talk frankly with your sons through your words on the page?
I guess it's because, as a novelist my entire life, I've come to trust and believe in the power of story. Without explaining the story, without tidying up the causes of human behavior, to me, that's a little bit like joining a magician backstage where you see how the trick is done and it's no longer full of wonder and awe and delight. So I prefer to let the anecdotes of life speak for themselves. If they're lengthy, that's fine. If they're short, fragmentary, that's fine. But just trust in observing and listening to human behavior as it unfolds.
You just let the rabbit out of the hat, though. You love doing magic tricks, and especially around your kids. What attracts you to magic?
Well, I've done it since I was, 7 years old, something on that order. And it was a way, I suppose, of escaping some of the stresses inside my house in Minnesota. My dad was an alcoholic. There were late-night arguments between my mom and dad. And I would go down to the basement and practice magic, a kind of escape. And then I abandoned the hobby for many years, took up writing, which was, in a way, not identical, but similar in that a novel is an illusion of people doing things and struggling with things, just in the way magic is. So I think that the hobby of magic led me into becoming a writer.
And so you still have these shows where you might have 90 people in your audience doing a little magic show.
Yeah, we actually bought a house. It was big, and the living room was big enough to have 100 people or so. And we practice. There's about 9 or 10 of us who get together for 8 months and practice every couple of weeks and then put on a 2-hour magic show with singing and dancing and a storyline with maybe 180 tricks or 200 or so, a lot of tricks that just flow by, and you hope to create kind of the aura of a magical world, just as when I write a book.
What do your sons think of that?
Well, they have different opinions at different times. They don't like being awake and backstage to come out and levitate in front of the audience. Back when they were 6 years old, we would float them around the living room, and we'd find them sound asleep. Sometimes they enjoy standing behind me and laughing as I make cards appear at my fingertips. They can see how I'm doing it. And they now and then say, "Dad, come on, join the real world. Let's go play some baseball."
Tim O'Brien is with us. He's a National Book Award-winning author, best known for his writings on the Vietnam War. His newest book, it's called Dad's Maybe Book, and it's about his experiences as a father. You can join in. Do you have letters from parents or loved ones who've passed away? When do you take them out and read them? Where do you keep them? And what do they mean to you? Join in the conversation at 800-642-1234. You can email ideas at WPR.org. Tim, this book is a collection of letters to your two sons. Tell us about how you kickstarted this, how you started writing these letters.
Well, it began with the birth of my first son when I was 58 years old. I was then an older, first-time father. And my second son was born 2 years later when I was 60. And it occurred to me almost immediately that when they began to know me, they would know an old man. That's how biology works. And I decided that above all else, I wanted to be a father who was present and a good father. So I stopped writing for about 10 years and focused on being a good dad. Over the course of those 10 years, now and then something would occur. One of the boys would say something. I'd say something to them that seemed to me worth putting on paper. I'd jot it down. And with the thought that, well, when I'm gone, these pieces of paper will be in a drawer, and maybe when they're in middle age or in their 20s or 30s, they'll see them and hear the sound of their father's voice coming through the vowels and the consonants of what I'd written. The pages added up, and eventually my younger son, Tad, saw them and asked if it was a book. And I said, well, I don't know, maybe. And he said, well, if it's good enough, will it be a book? And again, I said, maybe. And he said, well, one thing for sure, you've got to call it your maybe book. And I kind of dismissed it at first, but it occurred to me that my life had been more or less organized around maybe-ness. Back in Vietnam, every step was maybe I'll be alive with the next one, maybe not. And then I came home, and now in my old age, it's kind of the same. At 73 years old, every day is a maybe day, and every tomorrow is a maybe tomorrow. And I think that's eventually true for all of us. We're all, in one way or another, writing our maybe books full of maybe tomorrows.
And in those moments, in those words, you have strong feelings about absolutism and being absolutely sure of yourself. Why does that fear, do you have a fear of that?
Well, I think it's because so often I've been so certain of things and then later either changed my mind or modified and amended what I'd once believed. The perfect example is that all of us or most of us once believed in the Easter Bunny. It's real. We believed ferociously when we were 5, 4 years old, and of course no longer. And that's been true of so much in my life that I found myself modifying my previously held firm convictions. And I've been wrong in my life as often as I've been right, maybe more often. And so I think it's a thing that I try to transmit to both my sons, that the word maybe is not an evil word. It's not immoral. And I think it shows some humility that to say instead, I think, or I believe, or it seems to me, the rhetoric around us in this day and age is so full of absolutism. The declarations come out of my television set, you know, every single night that have an absolutist quality to them that can, in the end, prove dangerous, can kill people.
We're having an hour-long conversation with celebrated author Tim O'Brien. His new book is called Dad's Maybe Book. It's about becoming a dad later in life and leaving something for his own sons to better know their own father. How do you think being an older parent shaped the way you brought up your children and the way you see the world? What questions do you have about Tim O'Brien and fatherhood? Join in at 800-642-1234. We'll be back for more conversation. It's Tim O'Brien here on the Ideas Network. If you're just joining us, we have novelist Tim O'Brien here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. His new book grew out of years of random notes and thoughts on mortality and things he wants to tell his now teenage sons. He came to fatherhood in his late 50s. He did the math and feared that his sons would not get to know him well when they're at middle age. So what has been the most surprising or enlightening thing about parenthood? What have you learned or experienced that you never thought you would? Are there stories you hold close from your own parents? Join in at 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. The new book is called Dad's Maybe Book, and Tim O'Brien stays with us. Tim, let's talk about the time that Timmy, your oldest son, was a toddler, and you're at a writer's conference, and it's you have to stand up and you have to talk, and you tell about Timmy's first words. And through that story, you have a lot of aha moments about writing and about the blending of story. What happened there at Suwannee?
Well, I was required to deliver a lecture about writing. I don't like doing those sorts of things. It's not an abstract thing for me. So I thought instead I'd just tell a little story about Timmy's first words when he uttered a line from Shakespeare, "'Tis a tale told by an idiot," and how my wife and I had taken him down to the health facility and a perplexed nurse looked him over and kind of alarmed at the boy saying, again, "'tis a tale told by an idiot," calling in a doctor, also alarmed. But in the end, the doctor said this: he wasn't suffering from polio or cancer. A lot of infants will sometimes utter more than one word. They might say, "bye-bye, Daddy." And my wife said, "yeah, but these are famous words." And the doctor said, I know, and prescribed some Xanax for us and sent us on our way. So I told this anecdote to 300 or 400 people in a hall, and they laughed. And then I conceded that I'd invented it, trying to demonstrate what a fiction writer does. We invent things. We use our imaginations, and we sometimes write not about how the world is, but how the world could be or should be. And after the talk, a gentleman came up to me and wearing a kind of a hat, straw boater hat that Gadsby might have worn. He was furious. He said, "You made us, you know, laugh at a lie. And why did you have to lie to us?" And I said, "I didn't have to. I wanted to. I wanted to show what a fiction writer does and the kind of emotions it can generate." And that is what a fiction writer does. It's why there are books and novel stories, movies, television dramas, you can go on and on, bedtime stories, that the human heart is not interested only in reality. The world is also interested in Thumbelina and the Big Bad Wolf and fairy tales.
I can imagine that your bedtime stories to your sons were absolutely spectacular.
They were so funny. I'd go after his teachers, Timmy's teachers and Tad's teachers populated most of my stories, not always doing really great things. They were funny stories, and it's a good way to go to sleep at night laughing.
It takes you into the dream world in the right way. Let's take a call now. Amanda is coming from Stevens Point here. Amanda, hi.
Hello. Thank you so much for taking my call. One of the things that sort of struck me is that I have taken from my own mother and passed along to my daughter is just taking the joy out of, you know, the world. This time of the year where, you know, the beautiful leaves. My mother and I would drive around and look at trees, and I do that with my daughter. And in fact, to the point where we were running late for to get her to a class, and we both simultaneously stopped, looked at the ground, saw the leaves, and both said, "No, wait, we gotta go."
I love you that you carry on that tradition. That's really wonderful.
Yes. And it's something I love that I know that I'm sharing that from my mother, you know, to my daughter, and hopefully she will share it with her children as well.
Tim, what about the deliberate act of sharing that tradition or just that little thing that you do that you want your own child to carry with you?
Well, we have our traditions, of course. They're often, you know, broken at times. We do odd things, too, out-of-the-way things. For example, many years back when my kids were 7 and 9 years old, we were vacationing in southern France at a way too expensive place. We didn't know it would be this expensive. The pizza tasted like duck liver. The Coca-Colas cost $30 a glass. And I remember my wife and I sitting out at an outdoor restaurant watching our kids play ping pong outdoors. The phone rang. It was my sister calling from San Antonio, Texas, to say my mom had died. And I can remember how out of place I felt halfway around the world, looking down at the blue Mediterranean and the bobbing yachts and this ritzy hotel where everybody looked like George Hamilton, not like us. I went over to the ping pong table and told the boys my mom had died. They didn't say much. I didn't say much. And for the next couple of hours, we just stood hitting that ball back and forth. And then later, and as dusk began to come down, our family walked down a long sloping hill to a little village where there was a cheap restaurant. And I took Timmy's hand, and I said, "Are you thinking about Grandma?" And he said, "No, I'm thinking about you thinking about Grandma." Well, there's an example of your children teaching you as opposed to you teaching your children. I learned something about human empathy that'll last with me forever just through that little story of what had occurred that day. I had thought this little boy was so wrapped up in his little boy thoughts that he wasn't capable of that kind of thought. And it's one of those miraculous things that I felt compelled to press into the pages of a book.
Tim O'Brien is with us. His newest book is called Dad's Maybe Book, about his experiences as a father. You can join in with your experiences at 800-642-1234. Tim, your son, Timmy, loves basketball, but as a freshman year in high school, he wanted to join the basketball team, didn't make it. What do we know about your wanting the best out of athletics and yet, when kids don't live up to those expectations?
Well, what a great question. It's one of the burdens, I suppose, of fatherhood is that all around us, males participate more or less in some form of athletics. In our school, they're required to. Timmy took an incredible love for basketball from the time he was 7 years old. He practiced constantly. He got really good at it. And then in ninth grade, the tryouts for his high school team happened, and he got cut. It was, for him, a catastrophe, mortifying and humiliating. He no longer could hang out with his friends because they were playing basketball, and he wasn't. He stopped going to games. And at home, he would begin shutting his door. I don't know what was happening behind that bedroom door, but I know he was unhappy. I would ask him periodically at dinner, "Are you okay?" And he'd say, "I'm fine." But he wasn't fine. And then, maybe 6 weeks into this silence, the boy just went silent. He came out of his room one evening, and I was on the sofa reading a book, and he curled up with me. He's 6'1", I'm like 5'7", so he's a lot taller, but he still curled up to me, this 14-year-old boy. And he said, "Dad, I probably wasn't good enough." And I said, "Probably not." And then he said, "But Dad, I love you so much." And as any parent or any human being would, everything suddenly went into this sense of perspective where out of a catastrophe for the boy, this mortification he felt, out of the tight-lipped teenage blue came these miraculous words, "I love you, Dad," where something and kept him going through what for him was a nightmare. And I think it was the love inside our house.
We're talking with acclaimed novelist Tim O'Brien for the hour. His new book, first one in more than 15 years, it's a collection of thoughts, a gift in the form of letters to his teenage sons. Did you become a parent later in life than you thought you would? As an older adult, what was that experience like for you? How do you think being an older parent shaped the way you brought up your own children and the way you see the world? Join in, 800-642-1234. You can email ideas at WPR.org. We'll get back to our conversation with Tim O'Brien right after this news update. Stay with us here on the Ideas Network. You're with us on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Wisconsin Public Radio has a new podcast. It's called Derailed. It's about how high-speed rail almost came to Wisconsin, and the third episode is out today. This one looks at the backlash against high-speed rail. You can find Derailed wherever you get your podcasts or at WPR.org. Right now we're talking with celebrated author Tim O'Brien. The title to his new book refers to a time when he was reluctant to commit to this book, and his son Tad called it a maybe book, told his dad to put it in the homework bin, wish for an okay grade. It's about the best he can do. What have you learned or experienced through the eyes of a child? What have they taught you? Join in at 800-642-1234. The book is called Dad's Maybe Book, and Tim O'Brien stays with us. Let's go back to the phones now. Ed is joining us from West Allis. Hi, Ed.
Good morning. I just want to thank Mr. O'Brien for one of the greatest images on Vietnam in his book. He referred to our conflict there as fighting the eternal Ding Dong. And you laugh at that image, and then you realize the tragedy of it as well. And I think when you have a great image like that or a metaphor, I think that should be praised. My comment on children is I really think fathers really want to secretly kill their sons. And this comes around at the age of 18, when the males are told they have to register for the draft in this country. Those of us that are pacifists who stand up to war always have this great conflict. Our fathers, especially my era, my father was World War II.
And Ed, you're breaking up, and I do want Tim to be able to respond to you. You know, and Tim, you have a letter in this book about the men you fought beside in Vietnam. Could you read a passage from that letter?
Sure, I'd be happy to. I can preface it by saying that I dearly love the men in my old unit, Alpha Company of Vietnam. We endured together the unendurable. They were the most ordinary kind of guys, and yet they were extraordinary in how they would advance under fire and do what they had to do, obeying the most silly and lethal commands. I admired them so much. On the other hand, oftentimes their politics about Vietnam, not even politics, but their attitudes toward the war, appall me, and this little passage is about how I'm torn between my love for the men and some of the things that come out of their mouths. I remain torn between my affection for the men of Alpha Company and my dismay at their mostly self-congratulatory, mostly uncritical, mostly America right or wrong values. It's like being married to Oliver North. True, plenty of Vietnam veterans opposed the war, and plenty spoke out against it. And yet, studies show that the social and political attitudes of Vietnam veterans generally mirror those of non-veterans of the same age. Traditionalist, conservative, pro-military, and hawkish. These findings are predictable. Even back when they were young, the Minnan Alpha Company seemed more or less to fit the standard profile. And now, decades later, it's no surprise that their opinions have hardened along the lines of the aging male population as a whole. The real surprise, at least for me, is that the historical judgments of my old war buddies are served up without the linguistic spices of Vietnam, without a touch of the weird, without sarcasm or astonishment, without rock and roll dissonance, without wit, without ginger, and without the old FTA skepticism that was once scribbled on helmets and jeeps and M16s from Da Nang to the Delta. The tone of their voices, the music beneath their politics, sounds to me more like Sinatra than the Animals, more like My Kind of Town than We Gotta Get Out of This Place.
Thank you for that.
That captures my feelings about it. It isn't really a political issue at all. We've all endured something together. And, of course, we're all going to have different views about it. It's more the tone of how it's spoken, that it has a kind of nostalgia that wasn't present during the war itself. It's certainly there in VFW and American Legion halls now. But back then, we were scared, 20 years old, doing dangerous things and killing people. And there wasn't anything very nostalgic about it. The nostalgia came much, much later.
When you returned from Vietnam, you were enrolled at Harvard pursuing your PhD. And did you talk with your parents about that decision of dropping out of Harvard when you got so close to getting that degree?
Yeah, I was within a few months of getting the degree, but by that point I had written a book that did pretty well, and I had dreamed since I was a little boy of being a novelist. I didn't want to be a teacher, and I had embarked on a new book on my off hours after studying all day. And I called my mom and dad back in Minnesota, and I said, "Look, I'm close to getting the PhD, but I'm really at heart, I want to be a writer." And they were astonished. They had dreamed these big dreams for me of their son getting a doctorate. And we come from a very small town. Harvard was a big deal to my mom and dad. And the idea of dropping out in general, they didn't approve of. They thought it was a kind of quitting. For me, it was walking into what I wanted my life to be, like moving out of a room I didn't want to be in, through a door, and into the world of what I aspired to, which was to tell stories. And they said, "Don't do it." And as they said those words, I knew I was going to and did.
We guard against cowardice, though, as parents so closely that I wonder if that was part of this, that they were fearful of what might be on the other side.
They absolutely were. I think a parent's main concern in so many ways is simply the safety of their child. That's been my concern, not just physical safety, but protecting their psychological safety so they aren't bullied or so they can stand up for themselves, so they can become independent. And what I have to let go of myself as a parent, and probably all parents do this, is to allow independence. I did it when I left Harvard and went off and became a writer, despite what my parents were telling me. And I have to learn with my own kids that capacity to let go. And at some point, a child has to become an adult and and do what conscience and desire make a human being, as opposed to a parent saying, do this or do that. The letting go for me has been extremely difficult. I'll be sitting in the back seat, you know, and my kid is on his first date in college, singing Row, Row, Row Your Boat. I'll be back there. but eventually I will let go.
Tim O'Brien is with us. His new book is called Dad's Maybe Book, about his experiences as a father. You can join in 800-642-1234. Christine is joining us from Eau Claire. Hi, Christine.
Good morning. You asked a question about having a child later in life. I had my one and only daughter at 40, and yes, I learned a great deal. I certainly had no ignorance is bliss moments. At 40, I knew that it was going to be difficult and that for the most part, I'd be raising my daughter on my own. But I think one of the biggest things I learned was the reality of what love really means in terms of, you know, when it's 2 o'clock in the morning and your baby needs you, you make a choice. I mean, you make a choice to take care of the person that needs you. And when your baby throws up 9 times during the night and you give her 9 baths and have 9 loads of laundry in the morning, I mean, you do it because that other person needs you, and raising a child is a sacrifice and it's a joy. And I feel so fortunate to have my daughter in my life. She's 19 and she's in Spain taking a gap year, but it's been the hardest and best part of my life. I'm so thankful.
Christine, thank you for your words. Tim O'Brien. Go ahead, Tim.
Oh, mm-hmm. Well, I couldn't agree more with the caller. It is a sacrifice. I feared being a parent that I would resent the diapers and resent the din, and the din at bedtime, and all the things that accompany adulthood. And those things were tough to get through, but I think being an older guy helped me a little bit because I was much more patient than I would have been at 28 or 38, even 48. I was willing to do things that as a younger man I think I would not have been willing to do. I feared losing my own independence. I'd been without children for 58 years, and I was scared to death that I would now be tied down to a human being who hadn't been born yet. I didn't know yet. Well, it turned out to be the great joy of my life. I've now devoted so many years to writing this book. A book came out of it where I expected exactly the reverse. I thought I'd never write again. And it was a different kind of book. I'm well known for writing books about violence and war and Vietnam. And what a relief now to find myself writing about beauty and the intensity of love.
We're having a moment here with Tim O'Brien here on the Ideas Network. Stay with us. You're with us on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent, and we have Tim O'Brien with us for the hour. He's best known for his classic novels about the Vietnam War. His new book is about becoming a father in his late 50s. It's a collection of letters to his son, spurred by his fear that they may never really know their dad. And so we're exploring fatherhood and the writing process, life and death. With you as well, what questions do you have about Tim O'Brien's writing process? What do you want to share about fatherhood? What have you learned about your own family through letters? Join in at 800-642-1234. And Tim O'Brien stays with us. Let's go back to the phones now. Kay is joining us from Milwaukee. Hi, Kay.
Good morning. Thanks for taking my call. I called because my child changed my reality, and that is I was looking out and depressed and sad because my yard was full of weeds and I would never be able to clear them all. It was enormous. And my daughter looked out the window at the same yard I was looking at, and she said, "Look how pretty." gold and green. It's so beautiful. And I looked out and said, those dandelions are gorgeous. My yard is full of flowers. I have a garden. And it changed my reality, and I never tried to weed them again.
Never looked back. Kay, thank you so much. Tim O'Brien, it's all about how we see things.
It really is. The anecdote was just told just a second ago reminds me of something very similar that happened with me. Equally short, that my son Tad and I, when he was 7 and 8 years old, were watching a basketball game on television. Very tight and exciting game. And right in the middle of it, Tad said, "Hey, Dad, that guy in the Bible, Methuselah, how old was he?" And I was startled, but I said, "I don't know, maybe 1,000 years old." And Tad said, "Wow." And then another half hour, an hour went by, and was still watching the game. And again, out of nowhere, Tad said, "What exactly did he eat?" And the comment alerted me to, first I chuckled, but when he went to bed that night, I was thinking, I wonder if he's looking at me as Methuselah. And this question about what does Methuselah eat to get him, you know, to be 1,000 years, he's thinking about me to make me eat my broccoli to keep me alive. So you do look at the world in a brand new way.
You were in the car with your sons and saw what looked like a well-dressed homeless person. And one of your sons was deeply moved by this, crying uncontrollably. Seeing something that didn't cause you to cry in the same way, what was that experience like?
It was astonishing. It was probably the most memorable experience for me of the last 30 years. He had seen a man who probably was homeless, but not for sure, because he was not well-dressed, but cleanly dressed. He was wearing a white cap that said Vietnam Veteran. But the man himself on the street was crying. And Timmy yelled, "Stop the car, stop the car. We have to help that man." And we couldn't stop. It was rush hour. There was nowhere to stop. Timmy cried for the next 45 minutes all the way home. At dinner that night, he cried again. He got out of his chair and lay on the floor and just bawled. The next morning, 5 in the morning, I found him sitting on the kitchen counter, and he was packing a brown grocery bag with gifts for what he called his friend on 15th Street. That's the street on which he'd seen the man. Into this grocery bag, Timmy put a yo-yo and some fishing line, an apple, a granola bar, a copy of one of my books. I mean, just odd things you wouldn't expect to go into a gift package. And then for the next month or so, he made us drive up and down the streets of Austin, Texas, looking for his 15th Street friend, to a man who had been crying on a street. Well, a year goes by, and I thought Timmy had eradicated this memory. He never mentioned it again. I thought he was thinking about basketball. And then one day for an English assignment, he was asked by his teacher to write a personal poem. And he wrote a poem called My 15th Street Friend. He hadn't forgotten. It wasn't the poem's literary merits that astonished me. It was that all this time, a little sixth-grade boy had this memory of a man crying on a street for whom he felt such empathy. I don't think many of us, when we pass by the homeless, cry. We might give a buck or two. But there's a kind of, as you move into adulthood and you become accustomed to the troubles of the world, I think something hardens inside us. Kafka calls it the frozen sea inside mankind. And the one thing I really wanted to do with this book was just take an axe and just slash into the frozen sea inside me, because I was alerted to it by that little boy.
how do you get your sons to write? I know when I was a kid, my parents used to force me to write stories, and then they bound them together in this like makeshift book and made me do illustrations. But it was always like, you must do this. How do you make sure that your sons are writing?
Well, I supervise it. I edit what they do, and I make suggestions. I make them rewrite. I won't, when I edit, I won't say, do this. I'll circle something and say, this is, I don't understand what this sentence means. And I'll send them back. They have become so used to it. They live with a writer, and they physically see me rewriting and struggling to make good sentences or sentences I think are good. And I think they've come to kind of enjoy it. Not wholly, not completely, but they've done it since the time they began writing, way, way back. And they've become, both of them, in different styles. They've both become excellent writers. Their stories and their essays and so on that they do for school constantly delight me, the way I'm delighted when I read The New Yorker or when I'm delighted when I'm reading a novel. They aren't yet perfect, but they're approaching real excellence as writers.
I wonder, you write about how your legacy will be shaped as a war writer, and that's fair, but that's necessarily something that you want because you don't see yourself or you're writing that way. What do you think about along those lines?
Well, the reasons behind the war books are many, but among those reasons is that I thought by displaying the nastiness of war, the memory of a little girl lying dead in a rice paddy, would make people think twice about doing it, get a little less bellicose in their rhetoric at the PTA, a little less belligerent at the Kiwanis Club. That's what I was hoping for. I thought of myself as a peace writer who was urging peace through the stories about war. That's one response to it. I do feel that I am, in a way, giving voice to a lot of men from my era, all men back then, who have gone silent, who cannot and will not talk about it. It's buried so deep. Who yearn to talk about their hurt and their pain they still carry, the fear that they still keep, awakens them late at night. And that's the plus side of it, where I feel that I'm doing something that for my buddies who don't have the outlet that I have.
Tim O'Brien, thank you for joining us.
What a great pleasure.
Tim O'Brien's new book is called Dad's Maybe Book, which is a collection of letters to his sons. He's speaking at Boswell Book Company tonight in Milwaukee, 7 o'clock. And he joined us today from WBEZ in Chicago. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. This is The Morning Show. You're listening to the Ideas Network.